All right. How's everybody? Spring is back in San Francisco, huh? It's strange. Okay. Hey. I was just telling Ian I was on the phone half an hour ago to Transylvania. So then to fly across the bay. You gotta love the modern world, man. Modern world. I'm on a conference call. You call into a number in Houston, but no one's in Houston. Everybody calls that number, the bridge, you know. And I got someone from New York. I got a guy from Transylvania, and me. I didn't know Transylvania was a real place. Jean-Bor, if you're listening to this, I apologize. No disrespect. He's a good man. Okay, let's talk about this book. Who Etiquette Dictionary? Oh, jeez Louisa. Augustus. Okay. Why is it called Poetical Dictionary? That's a keen question. Augustus asks, why is it called Performative Dictionary? What's at stake? Before, you don't necessarily have to answer the question. How would you even address the question? What's at stake in the question? Does that make sense? I think to answer the question might exceed us and exceed what we're capable of talking about in here, certainly what I'm capable of talking about. But what's at stake in the question? What changes from calling it Performative Dictionary to Poetical Dictionary?
It's a specific type of performance.
Okay, what and are you suggest say more about that?
That it's written in as opposed to generalizing it to just performance. It's more specific.
Specific to what?
The technique that's used with writing.
And what's that technique?
Ah,
that's the question on the table. Very good, right? So it's not just that it's performative. There seems to be what's at stake here is that it is making a claim about poetry and about the nature of the poetic, right? And that there's something about the poetic that facilitates or augments or extends or is at the heart of this project. And so when Lauren taught, he actually taught a couple years ago. He taught here before. When he taught a couple years ago, he taught a class on poetry, on the rhetorical poetry. And the class was actually a cool class. I guess none of you took it, right? No. And it wouldn't make any sense. Not Ian, you didn't take that class, did you? No. It was a class on The Argument from Experience was the subtitle, right? And it was a class on is there a way that language, that the poetic suggests a certain kind of intimacy in the relationship between language and experience? If that makes some sense. That if prose at some point abstracts from experience, right, the traditional dictionary, is there an implicit argument in this book, calling it Poetical Dictionary, that there's something about the poetic, about poetry, that suggests the efficacy of the performative, of performing the performative, in a sense? I don't know. These questions exceed me. I don't know anything about poetry, as Priscilla knows. Okay. When we last left our hero, we were on page 14 of the preface, kind of. We were all over the place, but let's try that, which is XIV, or XIV. I guess I should be careful of my grunting and sighing. There's like a microphone on me. I guess it's probably disgusting to hear me grunt and sigh. I feel like I need a bunch of private sounds. Maybe I'll turn this off for a moment. I'll grunt and sigh.
Woo! All right. I'm a little schwitzy. I ran across campus. I literally was out of my house. I was in San Francisco at 20 to 11. Come on. All right.
We're back online. All right. We were talking about this. He says, rather than strip words of their variety, this poetical dictionary flexibly structures their heterogeneity like a coral reef. It gives the living standards for a system of multifarious life. Watch that language. Watch how carefully inflected it is. Right? Like a coral reef, this will to poetry and this constant will to metaphor, right? In the way that Nietzsche talks about it. Right, he's realigning knowledge systems. So all of a sudden, the dictionary is going to function like a coral reef. Right? that's not necessarily a figure that would readily come to mind, right? It's a kind of scrambling of knowledge, right? Of categorical knowledge. Does that make sense? So all of a sudden, this is like a coral reef. It gives the living standard. Oh, living standard, man. That's it. That's basically what we've been talking about from day one. On the very first day of class, I gave you the example of the two laws, you know, the mother who says, never drink, and the mother who says, do the right thing, be safe. That second one is really a living standard. It's of life. Like, living is a great word for two reasons. One, it's not just a life standard in that it pertains to, it is imminent to a life, part of a life, but also that it's living, it's active, it's a gerund, it's in motion. Right? It's a living standard. The standard itself moves, changes, adapts. The standard itself is in motion. The standard itself is in motion. That's really the argument of this class in a lot of ways. It's one of the main things that interests me about rhetoric. That you can decenter the world, you can dispense or render moot or secondary or tertiary questions of truth and certainty and proof, but at the same time and in the same breath, you don't get rid of standards. On the contrary, you multiply them. You proliferate them. And what rhetoric then in many ways is interested in are the different kinds of standards, different kinds of structures. Right? How does poetry structure something? How does prose structure something? What is it to call something philosophy? You call a class the rhetoric of philosophy. The question is, how does philosophy become a kind of standard? What are the standards there? Right? And it's not a standard that becomes a criterion of judgment, like the Ten Commandments, right, which are absolute sort of no-sayers, right? It becomes a standard that's living, that changes, that is folded into life as opposed to devoid of life. Right? It's a standard that literally emerges from within as part of, as both constituent and constitutive of the living experience. Right? Does that distinction make sense? Have I talked about that, the constitutive versus the constituent? Constituent. What's the difference between constitutive and constituent? What's constitutive mean? Good. It constitutes the thing, right? It makes the thing happen. And what is constituent? Exactly. Thank you, Ian, right? So the thing is that once the standard is at once is the situation and is at the mercy of the situation at the same time, right? It's why we've talked about from day one that the active-passive distinction doesn't really hold up, that rhetoric speaks in the middle voice, right? It speaks in multiple voices, and that middle voice is a place of multiple voices, active and passive. It's not just a question of acting on the world or being acted upon. You go with the world. Okay? The most explicit, again, example I always give in rhetoric is, you know, in the... you know, in any given situation, like Michael Jordan out on the basketball court, I'll always use Michael Jordan, he makes a decision on the court as part of the court. Everyone's reacting to him. He doesn't get to stop action and make a decision. He's both constitutive, right? He's part of the court. He's part of the action, right? He makes the action, quite literally, constitutive. But he's also constituent. He's at the mercy of it at the same time, right? A living standard. A standard that is both constitutive and constituent. This book is giving us a really exquisite, beautiful view of the world and an understanding. I always talk about it as an epistemology, as a relationship to knowledge, which it is, but it also gives us a kind of exquisite ontology. Is this a word we know? Anyone know what that means? Yep. So logic of being, of what something is. Right? And we'll get to that, because I think in his definition of a word, we get this unbelievably exquisite, psychedelic, like, vision of beings that are at once consistent and ever-morphing. Right? He says words are plastic. They go through time. Notice the way this book constantly talks about history, circumstance, history, right? And the way a word, it says, and some further on, a word is sort of stretched. It is its own sort of stretching through time, right? But it still is itself. Think how weird that is. It is itself, but it's changing all the time. It's itself, but it's changing all the time. Right? Well, then, is it itself? Well, yes and no. What it is to be itself is this one thing that changes all the time. So this one thing is itself many things that's changing all the time. Right? One way to picture this, and you might laugh because this reveals my sort of inclinations, is to think of a lava lamp. Right? And a lava lamp, a thing maintains a form, but it's constantly morphing. Right? You picture a blob of wax in there, right? And it kind of has its shape, and it keeps moving, but it is its shape. Sometimes it dissolves into another shape. Just like a word sometimes disappears within another word, or disappears altogether. Words, you know, join up with each other. Right? It's a contraption. It's a contraption. Different things commingle. So it gives us this very strange ontology of something that has a form, that is something, but that something is precisely its own perpetual way of changing. You are your changings. You are your style of changings. It means you have a limit, but your limit keeps changing. That makes me happy. Just thinking that idea brings me delight. I first thought that idea, you know, about 10 years ago, and it has never ceased giving me delight since. That something has a limit, but its limit is not on the exterior to it. It is what it is. You are your limit. You are the way you go. A living limit. Like a coral leaf, this poetical dictionary gives the living standard for a system of multifarious life. My God, what a system of generosity. Right? I think this book should be taught in political science, right? As models of governance. Models of governance. Right? Think about coming up with a standard that's living and that fosters multifarious life. Right? I mean, in many ways, it's the kind of, it's not that far-fetched or not that distant from, you know, the so-called founding fathers and the will to birth a state of multiplicity. Right? The whole, I've been watching a little of this John Adams thing on HBO, and I learned a couple of things. You know, I don't know anything about history. And it's kind of, it never really occurred to me that they were really dispensing with monarchy. Right? They were really very subconsciously creating a new system that was not hierarchical, that was democratic. Right? And everyone has the right to pursue happiness, meaning prosperity. The prosperity is not inherent in inheritance. It's not inherent in inheritance, right? It's not just handed down, right? That you actually earn it. Right? So they were trying to create a standard, a system. That's what the Constitution in many ways is. It tries to create a standard that can facilitate multifarious life. Does that make some sense? There are different ways you could think about creating a system of governance, right? A codified system, right? That doesn't actually try to create multifarious forms of life. It tries to create one form of life. That's actually the dominant mode in the world, right? The world, we're supposed to be very PC and let these, you know, and not, we're always criticized, but of course, most of the world is really big on its own system, like the French. Right? The French are very upset that they colonized part of the world, and now those people are living in their country. Very upset by this. They beat them regularly. Friends are exceedingly xenophobic. Right? They like themselves. They don't like other things. French governance. I don't know. I'm not speaking about French people. So like a coral reef, it gives a living standard for a system of multifarious life with individuals that wheel and flash before its calcified lattices. With currents tangling and spiky bulwarks, with mimicry, poaching and smelt, with dark shelter for soft bodies that show only an unblinking ogle of an eye. Here words are not so much defined as they are depicted in a kind of informed portraiture, a conceptual calligraphy. This is so nice, a conceptual calligraphy. Why is that such a great phrase? Why do I like that phrase? What is a conceptual calligraphy? What's peculiar about it? What does calligraphy mean? Mm-hmm. Right, it's a fancy way of writing, right? Of inscribing the page, right? So it is literally the ink hitting the paper in a particular way, right? In this kind of fancified way. But now we're talking about a conceptual calligraphy. So now concept is no longer separated from the paper, from the body. right? It's the point at which this invisible thing, the concept, is being inscribed quite literally in the flesh of the world, right? The point at which that ink, and you can, I love picturing, you picture a calligraphy pen that has sort of sharp metal points, right? And you kind of put in the ink, and the ink kind of bleeds out like blood. Can you picture what I'm talking about? When I was in like fourth grade, I was into calligraphy. I feel like all fourth graders are, but maybe it was just me. But then you picture the, I can feel the way the metal kind of hits the paper and the ink kind of bleeds into the paper, right? And it's this kind of, literally a bleeding and an absorption. It's so sensual. And now picture that as concept, a conceptual calligraphy. Oh, that is amazing, right with concepts. Right? Nietzsche did a similar thing in that he made concepts palpable. He talked about them being cold, right, and bony. And it's a strange thing to make the invisible all of a sudden quite palpable, quite physical, quite sensual. But what's, you know, I, in the beginning of the semester, I read aloud, we read the Roland Barthes, talking about the grain of the voice, which was really the body of language devoid of concept, devoid of meaning. Pure massage, no message. Does that make sense? That's what we're really talking about. And maybe I talked about this a little bit, right? Like lying in bed and saying the word zucchini over and over to yourself until it has no meaning. Until it's just this weird series of sounds that you either like or don't like, but that punctuate your body in a certain way. Zucchini, 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 zucchini. You get to a certain point and the meaning will fall away. To me, it was always zucchini because I was very confused by zucchini as a kid. Found it repulsive. I couldn't believe its ubiquity in my house. So I would lie about zucchini, 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 right? Right? Now I like zucchini. Right? But that's one thing, right? That's almost the pure body of language, as if such a thing could exist. Right? That's that will in the end of that Barthes essay. Right? It's the will to this kind of pure physicality. Right? And I spent a long time in this class talking about the palpability or physicality of language to try to get us away from our prejudice towards the meaning or information or factum or a concept of language. But in fact, the space we want to operate in is a space that simultaneously and I guess there's no way around talking about the chiasm, chiasmatically, or inner, I don't want to say seamlessly, because there are lots of seams. But the way the concept, the meaning, the message, and the massage are simultaneous. You can't separate the two of them. That's what we've been doing ever since that part, right? That's the medium is the massage. It's the message and the massage. You can't separate them. That's McLuhan's argument. That's Green's argument here. His words are defined not simply for their sensuality. He says, what happens when we fold the sensuality and the concept together? What kinds of new information, what kinds of new knowledge do we get? When we take the body of the world and fold it into its meaning, we get an entirely new mode of knowing, an entirely new kind of knowledge. Right? That's what this dictionary gives us, a new kind of knowledge that is simultaneously conceptual and physical. And the two are not the same, and there are differences. You can talk about a concept without talking about its body per se, although the invisible has bodies too. Just so you know, maybe Lauren will yell at me listening to this, that Lauren's new book that he just finished writing is a textbook of atmospherics. Right? And it's a way of breaking down all the spaces and affect of the invisible, in a sense. Right? What is the affect or space of a certain kind of time, of a certain, of the atmosphere? The atmosphere of a room, the atmosphere of a beach, the atmosphere... I got to read the book, to be perfectly honest. I just got a copy, right? But that's... The invisible has a shape, too. Right? You ever hear an idea? Like, I gave you the idea of that limit. And that idea fills me with a kind of almost erotic joy. It turns me on, I got to be honest. I like that idea. I like to spend time alone with that idea, right? It's a good idea. Right? That's kind of the body of an idea. An idea, a concept, the invisible has certain shapes. Right? Music, an obvious thing that's invisible that has a certain shape, right? Has a certain rhythm, has a certain architecture. Is that fair to say? Is that fair to say music has an architecture? We can notate it, but it exists completely aurally, completely phonically. Does that make sense? Like, clearly the architecture of, you know, super minimalist music versus, like, Jimi Hendrix versus, you know, whatever the fuck you listen to, you know? And they all have different shapes, different rhythms. They make different, they have different architectures. Well, if that's true, well, then maybe all the invisible has a certain, you know, different architectures. I mean, smell is an obvious one, right? You can, smell has a certain shape. Okay. So what we're getting here is this thorough intertwining, this chiasm, which is a good trope. Good trope for you. The chiasm. Chiasmus. The name of another trope, which is the, it's actually more complicated, but I'll, for now I'll just give you, it's the intertwining of things. Right? There's a great essay called The Chiasmus, if you care, called The Chiasm by Merleau-Ponty. That you should read, but no one's going to listen to me. So one day maybe you'll read with me. All right, where are we in our fantastic book? Here, words are not so much defined as they are depicted in a kind of informed portraiture, a conceptual calligraphy, a combination of lexicography, whatever, and poetry. A lexitree that knows the style of information.
Huh?
Right? It's so weird to know the style of information. But of course, information has a style. Right? The will to the of the nihilist, of the scientist, is to make information purely abstract, pristine. It has no style. It just is. But of course, all facts have a style. One aspect of that is all facts are an argument. There's no such thing as a fact that's not an argument. Another way to look at that, another angle to look at that, is every fact has a style. Information has a style. It has a way of going. It has an operation. Right? So this is a lexitree that knows the style of information, the viscosity of concepts, the atmospherics of these sonic comtropic logics that we call words. Right? Even a lexicographical purist will have to admit that purple denotes its own style of prose. I love that parenthetical. Right? That it's hard to write about the purple without writing in a purple mode, right? Something about purple demands its own purple definition. Okay, so now we're going to get into the critique of the dictionary. Right? Because what I tried to make clear to you is that Dr. Green is giving us, is a is this fundamentally different ontology and epistemology. He's saying this thing called sense. This thing called sense includes both the meaning of a word, in a sense, and its palpability. Right? Augustus had that great word, posture. The word posture. Right? And when Augustus and I were talking about this the other day, I said, yeah, posture is good, but what's even better than posture is gait. These words have a gait. Why do I like the word gait better than posture?
There's a speed to it.
Yeah, it's moving. Right? Posture has a kind of stillness, or a way of holding itself, a particular stillness to it. Right? Look at everybody's posture. Dan has nice posture. A terrible posture, right? We all hold ourselves kind of differently, right? A good word for the way a body holds itself, and this is a really good word that will come in handy, comportment. Goes into comportment, right? The way you comport yourself, the way you are comported, it's the way you hang in the world, right? When I was in college, I never wore my glasses. My eyesight wasn't as bad. But also, I liked the blur. Anyway, I could only pretty much see, you know, about a foot in front of me, and I kind of dug it. It was just like me. But at a certain point, I could tell people from a distance who I knew by their comportment. Right? I couldn't possibly see their face. Right? They were just a way. They were a gait. They were this whole particular way of moving, and you begin to recognize that very quickly. Right? Does that make sense? Right, you know this experience, right? That's the comportment of something, right? And you can, if you really pay attention to someone, you can really begin to define their comportment. Right? How do they go? How do they hold themselves together in the world? And at some point, if you really wanted to talk about somebody's comportment, a relative or a friend, you would talk about their bodies. You would talk about little tics they have, by the way they eat. And at some point, you begin talking about the things they talk about, the things they think about, how they think about the world. At some point, it's very hard to really talk about the comportment of something without talking about the way it makes sense of the world. Does that make sense? You wouldn't just talk about its sensuality, its physicality. You would also talk about its means of processing the world, its way of knowing the world, the kinds of questions they ask, right? When I write letters of recommendation, right, I often try to speak to these things simultaneously. The way someone sits in a classroom and sits towards me and with a certain... I never separate their physical posture from their questions they ask. Right? They're often... Or the papers they write, right? I find the argument that brings them all together, even if they're discontinuous, right? Even if they're discontinuous. It's not always, you know, the person who's super on it in class, their papers might be awkward. It can be all kinds of different things. It's not always a one-to-one relationship. But it's... You try to speak to all of that at once. That's what this book is doing, right? That's how it's seeking to find words. It's scoping out a different domain of knowledge, a different domain of knowledge of what it is we even need to seek to know. That is unbelievable. It's redefining the very domain of what we will fold into our field or our fold as knowledge. He's amplified the field of knowledge. He hasn't said, no, we won't know things. Forget about knowledge, just have experience. What he's done is taken experience and made it part of knowledge. That's the nasty, beautiful move here. Right? That's why it's supersessive. That's why he says, listen, what I'm doing here is of help and I'm a colleague of the scientists, right? I'm talking about, you know, matter too. Scientists could learn from plastic, the word plastic. Just as I can learn from them. It's part of the same thing. We're all poets. Right? He's increased increased, but also reshaped, redefined the domain of what is considered knowledge. Information has a style. That style is itself information. Right? So you can forget this whole, you know, he or she is beautiful on the inside. Right? We don't separate the inside from the outside. It's all the same package. It's why Nietzsche, in his great critique of Socrates, we talked about this. It's one of my favorite moments in philosophy. Right? It's towards the end of Nietzsche's writing, and he's getting very pithy, and he has a chapter in his book called The Problem of Socrates. He says, the problem of Socrates is obvious. He's ugly. Everyone knows it. Right? And to the Greeks, that was enough of a refutation. Right? It's a sign of a thwarted development, he says, of an ill-constituted being, of a criminal mind. Right? Because you can't separate the body from the concept, or the concept from the body. The two are wed. Right? It has to be the best moment of philosophy. And the best is everyone knows it. Which is true. That was part of Socrates' thing. He's an ugly old man, but everybody, all the little boys want to sleep with him. Because he's wise and charismatic. And he is wise and charismatic, you know? I mean, there's something to be said for that. Thank God. All right, okay. Though the traditional dictionary is an established wonder of information science, a masterpiece of dedicated scholarship, you can see a move similar to Nietzsche's here, where he takes the thing that's presumably free from aesthetic critique and gives it kind of an aesthetic critique, right? The traditional dictionary is an established wonder of information science, a masterpiece. Again, this aesthetic language to talk about this thing that claims to be free of aesthetic critique, right? You don't critique a dictionary the way you critique a novel or a poem, supposedly. But here's Dr. Green doing precisely that and liking it. It's a masterpiece of dedicated scholarship. An astounding compression of what we know in language. But it often loses its sense of words. For this reason, the standard dictionary is also a tome of variable tedium, decorated with deadpan illustrations and punctuated with the occasional intrigue, yet characterized by a monochromatically curt retentiveness. Right. It's voice. You read a dictionary. We've talked about this. It really tries to speak in that same voice, and it's so like... It's so curt. Curt's the perfect word. I don't know another word for it. They don't want to spend any time. They don't want to linger, even over linger. Right? They don't want to, you know, they don't want to indulge, even over indulge. I mean, how can you give a curt definition of indulge? Right? Should be sumptuous. Its compendious destiny acts as a stack of fine mesh screens, precisely fitted to catch and sort the special beings that are words. But once caught, they are immobilized, dried, and parsed, then eulogized with accurate, if perfunctory, remarks. Right? And this is a figure I've used a lot. Right? That the dictionary tries to use a sieve, a screen. Just, right? That if I throw all the words in this screen, I'll capture all the body, all the style, all the physicality and sensuality of words in the screen, and what will come out in the bottom will just be concept, just meaning. And then we can just throw away the body of words. Right? And that's the image Green's giving you here. Does that make sense? Can you picture this image? Right? You try to separate yourself from the kind of sumptuous of language. I mean, can you picture being a dictionaryist, which I know has another word, which I don't know. And you, do you know this word? No. I know there's a close. I think there's another word for someone just as dictionaries, maybe. Those are both good words, though. You come to a word and you're moving through it and you're defining, desk and table, and then you get to sumptuous. You got to speak in the same voice. Doesn't that seem weird? Or you get to voluptuous, or salubrious, how can you define these words? I mean, wouldn't you? You'd have to fight yourself, right? To kind of shy away from the more sort of obvious temptations to indulge the word a little bit. Foreplay. Right? Foreplay is such a good word in here, and we'll talk about the particular definition of foreplay in here. But you're the dictionaryist, and you're not supposed to be poetical, right? You're just supposed to talk about the sense of the word. You got to talk about foreplay, right? And picture the sieve. Picture the bodies having all that fun, going, hitting the sieve, and then they get stuck there, and all you got is the meaning. Jeez. Talk about stripping the fun out of foreplay, right? All right. Right, so he takes an example, Nabokov's favorite beings, a butterfly. Right? It's defined in a Random House College dictionary as, quote, diurnal insect of the order Lepidoptera, characterized by clubbed antenna, a slender body, and large, broad, often conspicuously marked wings. Right? Hilarious, right? It just doesn't really sound butterfly-ish at all, does it? Here, the lifeless, hueless insect is stretched and pinned in a Linnaean chart of Neo-Latinate relations, its slim body, big wings, and clubbed antenna, the only points of contact between meaning and the being that we know to be the often brightly colored, clumsy joy that seems to hiccup in its flight. That's nice, right? You hear that one line, the clumsy joy that seems to hiccup in its flight. And don't you know the butterfly? Right? The butterfly is not the seamless, graceful, pigeon. What's seamless and graceful, right? It just glides, right? The butterfly can't glide, right? It has that, it's an insect, for God's sake, right? And so it's kind of like this caterpillar with these weird, beautiful wings, but it's so like, it's staccato. It has this weird, punctuated mode of flying. Does that make sense? Can you picture this butterfly? Butterflies just don't glide. Right? It's not the butterfly's mode. It's not like, right? The fact is, it only's going to live for like 2 days. It's got to get out there, make some nookie, and be gone, right? Isn't that its job? Yeah. Didn't think I made that up. Right? Right? And while the lepidopterist himself, Nabokov always felt for the metaphoric turn of life through words. Right? And it is conspicuous, right? The Nabokov, that's what he was. He was a lepidopterist. Right? He loved butterflies, collected butterflies. But he simultaneously, he understood words, is what Lauren is saying. So if you've read Nabokov, how many people here have read some Nabokov? Some of you. Should be required in like the third grade. If only I were king. For some words, the traditional dictionary is apt. Methodical fits squarely in the lexicographical grid, and stiff is perfectly in character. Right? If you need to define curt or stiff, right, or grid, well, then the dictionary seems like the actual right mode. So you get this happy coincidence a fair amount of the time, or a good amount of the time in the dictionary, where certain words actually do fit the dictionary's mode. Coincidentally, the dictionary performs certain words very well, including the words like curt or grid or stiff, because the dictionary is curt and stiff and a grid. You with me? On the other hand, wit is slow and serious. Ineffable is concrete, bounded, explained. Voluptuous is wan. But it does seem hilarious to define ineffable, doesn't it? Do you know what ineffable means? Well, that's all I'll say then. Because that performs itself. In fact, as the case of the butterfly indicates, most words do not thrive in the traditional dictionary. Hold on. Yeah, sometimes, you know, sometimes it does work. Blah, 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 blah. And then jump down a little bit. Very last two sentences of that paragraph says, Caudry's Table Alphabetical of 1604, often purported to be the first dictionary of the English language, also sometimes had a sense, perhaps more conceptual, of the being of words. That book defined the word aberration twice. What's going on there? All right, we'll keep going and see whether you get it. All right, this poetical dictionary, again, notice the return, the refrain of this, the particularity of this dictionary, right? And then again, this, by using this, it suggests others, this or that, right? So it doesn't seek to be definitive. The mere use of that word, this, is an argument that opens up the possibility of knowing words inherently to multiple ways of knowing words. It erases the will to the definitive without, however, erasing the will to the thorough. Right? This dictionary doesn't flakily define words. Right? We tend to think of the poetic as this kind of addendum, this ornament, something not serious. Right? But what we're learning, perhaps, is that the best way to understand the world is perhaps not through the serious. But the serious is actually a kind of lie. And it's precisely through a kind of play or kind of indulgence of ornament that the world becomes much fuller. An ornament becomes information. This poetical dictionary is an abridged version of a voluminous enormity of a book that contained definitions for nearly all the words existing in the English language, with one exception and one omission. What were the exception and omission? Thank you, Ian. Yes. Right? Exception and omission. If you're really going to perform your poetical dictionary, you really can't have omission, could you? Does that make sense? If you really want to perform the definition of omission, it would have to be omitted. You with me on this? We all together, right? It's why he says that the Caudry's Table Alphabetical of 1604 might have really understood words because it defined aberration twice, which is an aberration. Performed itself. Okay. Huh? Well, aberration wouldn't be omitted. Well, it is. It says in the it is, with one exception and one omission in this book. Very good. Okay. Right. Following the standard practice of lexicography, every word that appeared in the unabridged poetical dictionary as part of the definition was defined elsewhere. This proved problematic. The relations of the parts to the whole caused a constant churning within, and the book kept recounting the world. Green bled into brown, the pantheon clashed above, Buddhism met the shopping mall with poise, and monsters threatened to overwhelm the papery orange flare of a California poppy some 320 pages away. Why? What's going on here? The book worked furiously like Babbage's steam engine calculator, speculated on the cosmos like the pre-Socratics, organized production like a capitalist system, comprehended all in a unified field theory and came unbound in both utopic and dystopic anarchy. What's he talking about? Why? What's happening here? What is this unabridged poetical dictionary? Why does it work like Babbage's steam engine calculator? How can it do all these things? Even contradictory things. What's he talking about? You guys didn't really get this book. Or is it just so obvious you don't want to answer? Right, we talked about this a little bit the other day. The unabridged version had every word in it and every word was performed, then the entire book would be the entire cosmos, folded within its pages, right? It would have to perform like Babbage's calculator and also like the Burroughs adding machine. It would have to perform like every single one, and those they start arguing with each other or harmonizing. It would be an impossible cacophony and simultaneous harmonious symphony. Right. It would be the entire world. Yeah.
The other bridge constantly going through
a book. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, you should see it. It's weird on the shelf, right? Because you have to get a very strange bookshelf. It's a little deeper than most bookshelves, right? And it actually has to have a little guard rail on the front because it's, I mean, if you want to live with the thing, because it's always falling over on the kids' heads, and it's big. It's big. And sometimes it falls over like a slinky, which is strange, but sometimes it literally falls off like water, and it's a big mess, you got to clean all up. It's unwieldy. It sometimes just falls like an anvil, right? Boom, it's actually put a dent in the floor. There's only two copies. I have one. I would bring it in, but it doesn't fit in the cars.
So the abridged version has the scope in which he's trying to give us, and you're saying the unabridged version is just the proliferation of everything, cosmos, everything.
Well, it's every word ever, defined in relationship to every other word, and performed, right? So you have the entire world. It's I'm telling you, it's a strange, it's a complicated book. It's very expensive to print.
You got the Jumanji board game on the same shot.
I don't know what that is, but yes. So despite the great usefulness of the unabridged poetical dictionary, therefore, it had to be abridged, right? Because otherwise there's no way we could have taught it. It's unwieldy. It was very expensive to print. It was prohibitively expensive. So this version's slender volume of all the more distinctly keeps the wobbling rhythm of a contraption, the patient metabolism of an oyster, the convolutions of an eddy, and as in Miro's paintings, the symphonic float of a cosmos of being stopping only occasionally to twigger with the proximity of all its weightless stars. Look at the very next line, and then we'll jump ahead a little bit. No one overriding principle of selection operates behind the words finally included in this abridged version of the poetical dictionary. This book has a relentless will to the multiple. Right? So even in its edited version, this abridged version, right? There's not one overriding principle of selection. So even in the principle of selection is multiple. So how we decided to edit it, which words went into here. And notice there's kind of an odd hodgepodge of words. Right? How why these words? Right? Sort of an odd mixture. We have affect, bulwark, doom, ganglion, latent, pixel, queasy, salubrious, torpid, veer, salient. How'd those end up in here? Well, no overriding principle, right? Because there's never an overriding principle. It's all distributed. It's all multiple. You don't need an overriding principle. Right? Our culture, our instinct is to go towards the unified theory, the unified model. We talked about this a while ago, but I watched, one segment of this documentary on string theory a little while ago. And it was hilarious, right? So string theory claims to be the unified theory, right, of all matter. This will define everything, right? If Newtonian physics covers some stuff and Einsteinian physics covers some other stuff, string theory will account for everything. And they call it the unified theory. Right? The problem they were having was it wasn't unifying, right? So one little school of scientists was saying, no, there are seven dimensions. And the strings are squiggly but straight. And the other guys say, no, there's nine dimensions, and they curve. Right? And in another school, they had five different schools. And they found it embarrassing. Right? So all of a sudden, there's all this money pouring in, all this research to get the grand unified theory, but now they got five grand unified theories. Right? And people begin to question the amount of money that gets invested in this research begins to be questioned, because if you can't unify everything, what good are you? That's what we're paying you for. When the move was so obvious to a rhetorician, right? I mean, it's hilarious. It was too perfect. I couldn't even believe it, right? The blind spot in their own thinking was so conspicuous. It was weird, right? That the unified theory is a theory of multiplicity. Is itself multiple? Isn't that just the obvious answer? Rhetoric is the unified theory. Because it's the position of all positions, including the position that it faces, the position of all positions. Boom. That's done. There you go. There you go. There's a unified theory for you. I did it. All right? And not only, it's not just a string. Sometimes it's a string. Sometimes it's not. There's your unified theory. Sometimes. Sometimes. That basically comes down to that. Sometimes. Sometimes it's this. Sometimes it's that. Wouldn't you think?
I would think so.
I would think so, too. But these scientists are all panicked, right? And embarrassed was the word they kept using. I said that was hilarious. They see, and there you see the melding of morality with science and truth, right? They feel shame, right? That they can't unify, right? That the will to one thing is the will to a one God, the will to a one theory, the will to a one truth, right? It's all the same, what Nietzsche would say, nihilistic tendency towards the univocal that doesn't exist anywhere. But when I'm listening to this, I'm like, come on, put me on the team. I'll get you guys so much money. I'll write you a beautiful paper. Just kick some of that grant money my way. And I'll write you a nice paper. You can throw in your neat little diagrams. It'll be fun. I was like, I wanted to give them Leibniz to read. They don't read Leibniz, it seems. Otherwise, their answer, they wouldn't have the problem. They had to read Leibniz. It was so obvious. I was going to mail them a copy. All right. Right, so no one overriding principle of selection operates behind the words finally included here. Okay. There's so many good things in here. All right, look at page 18, XVII, under pronunciation. Second full paragraph there. Region, time, mood, and musculature all converge to pronounce a sense of the word, a sense that varies with all these variables. I love that sentence, that phrase, varies with all these variables, but that is yet constrained by something, some sensual standard, some way of being. That's what I was talking about, right? This thing that is at once bound. Let's think about a word. Take any word. Give me a word. Give me a good word. Transliterate. Yeah, it's a combination of things. Without roots. Give me something without a root.
Ascension.
Ascension?
Ascension.
Ascension. Okay. If, you know, there a bunch of linguists have done this. One of them is Roman Jakobson. I don't know why I know this fact. I guess from my dissertation. He taped all these people saying the same word over and over. You know, different people saying the same word. So they said it all repeat. Individual people said it repeatedly, and then multiple people said the same word. So we took this word sentient. And sentient out of my mouth is different than sentient out of Ian's mouth. And it's going to be slightly different out of everybody's mouth. Does that make sense? We don't all speak in that weird computer voice. We all have slightly different ways of pronouncing sentient. Say the word. Everybody. One, two, three, sentient. Right? It becomes a harmony. I heard all different sorts of tones in there. Right? Which is weird. That means we didn't all say the same way. That means there's an infinite number of ways, different ways, of saying the same word. Is that fair to say? Seems sort of obvious, right? Seems obvious that there is an infinite number of ways of saying the same thing. And in fact, every way that thing is ever said is a particular way of saying it. Right? There is no right way to say it. While there are definitely wrong ways, there is no right way to say it. It means there's an infinite number of different ways to say something. Right? How do you say there's a country in South America that's also the name of a food? How do you say this name?
Chile.
Say it again.
Chile.
Yeah, people like to say, for some reason, Chile's one of these countries. My grandma was Chile, you know, that they like to pronounce by the way it's pronounced there. Chile. Right? Not many people really say Chile. And that always sort of confused me, because if we actually went that route and tried to say words as they were pronounced by their place, how micro would you get? Right? I know in San Francisco there's microclimates, right? So the Mission is very different weather than the Sunset, very different weather than the Haight, right? And they have to give, so pronunciation, I know at least in the five boroughs of Manhattan are very different. The Bronx speaks different than Brooklyn, speaks different than Manhattan, different than Westchester, different than Staten Island. Everybody speaks a little differently. So would you have to say each one differently? Right? So every time you said someone's name, would you have to say the way they, where they're from? It would get very, very strange. I kind of like it, but it would be very, very strange, right? The point being, what he says here, region, right? Region is this weird way of defining how we say certain things. So Chile, for some reason, we all say Chile. And that region really somehow took over. We all say that now. But people, how do you say the country that I constantly talk about in here? Right? That speaks a Romance language in the middle. Yeah, how can we all say France? How can we all say France? I don't know. I don't understand. It doesn't make any sense. Yeah.
You said earlier that there's a number of ways that you can say the word. If you say there's a wrong way to say it, what would be a wrong way to say it?
If I ask you to say France and you say blah, blah. Absolutely. And that wouldn't be wrong. That'd be stretching it, right? The point being that there is a, just because the limit is infinite and changing doesn't mean it's any old thing. The thing has a comportment. And there's clearly a point in which you leave that comportment. Right? Is it always so clear? Might you argue about it? Right? And that's what we're about to talk about now, right? Where he talks about, turn to the last page of the preface. Last paragraph. It says, rather than parsing sense from the word and uniformly imposing accuracy, clarity, concision, and simplicity, which are the standards of the dictionary, right, the standard dictionary, we sought to express each word's unique sense, and to do so relied on a different, more protean standard. So that's it. That's the phrase. That's going to be the title of my band. What is protean mean? What is protean standard? What does protean mean? Changing. Always changing. Something that's protean changes. It's a changing standard, a protean standard. Come on, that's a good band name. Do you guys ever listen to Ween? Is Ween like a popular band?
Yes.
Does anybody listen to Ween besides me? Like four of you? Right. I'm a big Ween fan. Ween has a protean standard, right? They'll jump at their best. The Beatles were like that, too. That's why I see Ween. Ween's like the modern Beatles. You listen to the White Album? Is that an album you all know? All right. It jumps all over the place, right? Helter Skelter, Cry Baby Cry. I mean, they go from like punk rock to little weird blues to psychedelic mumbling to, they're all over the place. It has a protean standard. Very different than that album you listen to that, like, you know, like Cowboy Junkies makes one mood. Right? You can picture bands that actually constantly try to be different with every song. And Ween in its heyday was always like that. And in between albums, right? They'll jump genres. Like prog rock, country rock, you know, disco. They'll just blue R&B. They just, every song, different standard. They'll just take on a genre over and over again. Protean standard. I got dibs on it. Of course, here too, even especially here, there is room for error. Why is there room for error in a protean standard? It's what we were just talking about. If the standard is living, if it's protean, if it's changing, then how can there be error? Isn't everything groovy?
It's plastic.
Okay, and what is it about plastic that makes room for error? Okay, but then how can there be error then? Right? But then, keep going. Why? How can I be wrong? It doesn't have a form. Then anything I say about it is okay. Anything I have to say. There's no standards, man. I could turn in any old paper and say anything I want. I wipe my ass with Poetical Dictionary. That's my paper caffeine. Done. Right? You say there's no standard. Fuck you. Here's my paper. Done. Right? Why not? Why not?
It's like the
be still, my beating heart. Right? Talking about infinite, bound infinity, man. When everyone's talking about bound infinity, life will be good. Yeah, there is still a limit. Just because it can do an infinite number of things doesn't mean it can do anything. Right? Infinity is differentiated. We've talked about that. Infinity is not a generality. The difference between the infinite numbers between 1 and 2 and the infinite numbers between 1 and a million, it's different. They're both infinity, but they're different. calculus is the science or the logic or the art. Calculus is the art of speaking and articulating these differentials, literally, within the infinite. How can we talk about a limit being infinite? How do we even get that? Why can I say a limit is infinite? For the very obvious reason, the very simple reason, that things are in time. The limit is in time. We are bodies in time. I told you that rhetoric is the art and logic of living temporally in time. And that means if it's in time, it's constantly changing. You can only have a fixed limit if things don't move. But if it moves, it changes. That's what movement is. Movement's a kind of change. Right? So if everything's constantly moving because it's constantly temporal, then the limit changes. It's infinite. Right? The limit of what you can be. Right? To be inspirational, this is my graduation speech, right? Is infinite. You can be an infinite number of things. Right? Because you don't know yet. You don't know what's going to happen. You could look at Barry Bonds, man. He went from being a speed demon to being a power hitter. He totally transformed his body. Who knew he could do that? You could say, well, he did steroids. So what? So he did some steroids. That's irrelevant for our conversation. He morphed. He became a completely different person. Do you know what I'm talking about? I would love to see it in a time lapse. Right, because he was like a skinny little guy. He was like a Hulk. Truly awesome. I actually feel, as an aside, that if taking steroids makes you hit the way Barry Bonds hits, it should be required in Major League Baseball. It would make the game so exciting. It would be like superheroes out there. If only steroids were that effective. Right? But that doesn't mean, right, the fact that you can be lots of different things, an infinite number of things, doesn't mean you can be anything, right? It would be very hard for me to become, you know, a very large, you know, 400-pound African-American linebacker, right? There are certain limits to what I can become. Does that seem obvious? But I can still become many different things, an infinite number of things, but not anything. I have a limit. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know where I'm going to go. I don't know if my limit is constantly changing with time. All kinds of things will happen. John was telling me this great story, a terrible story, but interesting story about Chet Baker, right, who's a trumpet player, gets mugged one night, gets his teeth bashed in. Can't play trumpet again. Can't make the same noise. So he reinvents himself as a singer, apparently a lousy singer, but he has to reinvent himself. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what's going to happen. Your limit is constantly changing. But that doesn't mean you can become anything, right? So there's a great line in Epictetus. I highly recommend reading Epictetus. He has a great book called The Enchiridion, which in Greek means the manual. The manual. He's an early Stoic. And he says, this is just one law. He says, know what's within your power and what's not within your power. If it's in your power, change it. If it's not within your power, who cares? Hence Stoicism, right? If it's bad, then fix it. You never have a reason to kind of be anxious or stressed or angry or pissed off. Because either it's not in your power, then who cares? If it's in your power, then just go fix it. It's kind of talking. It's like actually mapping the negative space, which would be kind of interesting, right? Talk of all the. If you tried to map all the ways you couldn't say, you know, the word sentient, is that your word? If you mapped all the ways you couldn't say it. I guess you could do that. It would be a much longer task, a stranger task. All right, let me finish my Epictetus tale here. Right. So there you got Epictetus. He says, you know, you grow up, you think you want to be a wrestler. You think you want to be a wrestler. He says, stop for a moment. Consider. Got the shoulders to be a wrestler? Are you sure you want to go in the ring? He's like, picture. He always asks you to picture yourself. Do you have the shoulders to be a wrestler? Do you have the legs to be a wrestler? Before you commit yourself to being a wrestler, ask yourself that, right? And so I did. I was like, no, I don't want to be a wrestler. It's just not your shape, right? What's within your power and what's not? What are your limits? That's what that question asks. Is it in your power or not in your power? There's another way of asking, what are your limits? What are your limits? You do have limits. Okay. There's certain things I might be able to perform with this hunk of being. And there's certain things I can't perform with this hunk of being. Right? But it's this very strange space, right, where there are limits, but the limits are changing. Right? And so Green says, it is here, especially here, where there's room for error. Does that make sense? Right? It's this very strange kind of assessment now, right? With this protean standard here, too, even especially here, there is room for error. Right? So let's think about this. Perhaps foreplay doesn't go far enough. Perhaps glee is overly boyish. Perhaps clumsy is too intentioned, and poise leans just slightly forward. These are the things that keep the editor of a poetical dictionary up at night. There is, after all, no privileged access to the being of words, but only sometimes a happy moment. What's another word for that? What's a word for happy moment? Come on, rhetoricians. Kairos, thank you. Right? There's only sometimes a kairos, a happy moment, in which they can be found to declare themselves a very particular or very universal this. And it is this, I hope, that is the joy of this dictionary, on each page, thoroughly and throughout. Each page asked, what is this word? What is it? Oh, it's a very rich paragraph. There is no privileged access to words. This is that great democratization, right? It's not the clean room analysis. It's not the incredibly learned person, right? Certain people, you just own certain words. You just own that word. You know that word. It's just because you own it in the sense that you go well with that word. Right? I mean, there's certain people when you hear like cursing coming out of their mouth, it just sounds all wrong. It just sounds all wrong. Certain people, I think when it comes out of my mouth, it often sounds harsh. And sometimes I forget that. Yeah, I'm ignoring that. No. Okay, we have like 5 minutes, right? All right? Let me turn this off. No, I'm not ignoring that. Okay, no. Now stop. For the lawsuit. Okay, the bell stopped, I swear. All right. Right, there's no privileged access, right? There's just this happy moment, a word comes to you. I talked about this the other day, you know, Lauren Green's in the subway, fetid. Fetid, been on the New York City subway in the summer. Fetid is a word that it doesn't just come to you, it like smothers you, right? I mean, it's really intense down there in the summer. I mean, it's, hot is not right. Hot doesn't describe the New York City subway. Hot, you guys think like LA, right? But the New York City subway in the summer, it's not hot. Yeah, it's thick. You know, you think you know humidity. You don't know humidity until you're down underground in that closed car with the stench and of Manhattan. I mean, that's fetid, right? Or the kid who tells me he's walking through Sproul and cacophony comes to him. A happy moment. A happy moment. You just see and feel that word. I see my little boy constantly. He's voracious in his will to vocabulary. Every word, how, what is that word, what is that word? And he'll use it over and over and over again, right? And he's obsessed with this, the phrase, I don't care. He first heard it, he didn't know what it meant, but he thought it was a bad thing. So he thought it was like a bad word. So remember, if he was really angry, he'd say, I don't care, right? And then I was trying to teach him, well, sometimes, he'd heard me say sometimes, you want to go there? I don't care. He'd be like, isn't that bad? I'm like, no. So finally yesterday, he wanted to go play outside. I was like, okay, we play outside, then we can't. You know, you're not going to watch your little TV show that he loves to watch. And he's like, I don't care. And then he thought about it. He said, and that's not a bad word. I don't actually care, Dad. I was like, very good. Right? It was a happy moment. It was a happy moment. He understood the word. It was amazing. And then about a minute later, he said, I could have said, I don't mind. And I was like, that is right. Right? It's a happy moment. Right? Where he's trying to figure out the limits of a word. Watch kids do that. They're all constantly trying to figure out the limit of a word. Can I use it here? Can I use it there? Can I use it there? What happens when I do this? What happens when I do this? What happens when I use it here? What happens when I use it there? All these different circumstances. And they're trying to live through it. Let the word inhabit them. Put it into play. See what happens. That's how they learn the limits of a word. How does a word go? Does that make some sense? All right? And obviously there are mistakes. There's a lot of room for error. So I ask you, did you think there were error? How would you assess some of these definitions? Does foreplay not go far enough? Or does it go too far? So look at foreplay. I had a very clever student. I'll wait till you get to foreplay. You notice the ending of foreplay? I had a very clever student say, yes, foreplay always ends in a colon. Which was his tendency and desire. So it was. I thought it was hilarious. It's a very good pun. Right, so you see the foreplay does end in a colon, right? So it's a hard sentence to say now. So it performs itself in that sense, right? That it's the inauguration of the next thing. But do you think it goes far enough or too far? You could see how we could argue this, right? Or any of the other words. Is clumsy clumsy enough? Or too clumsy? Is poise right? I told you my thought about acrobatic is that it plants its landing. And I feel that that's a really constrained notion of what of acrobatics. I want acrobatics to keep going infinitely. I don't want it to plan its landing. I think that planning its landing is not acrobatics, but is Olympic acrobatics. It's defined as the sport of acrobatics. Or acrobatics per se would be the infinite tumbling, tumble and tumble infinitely. That's where you could see, as the editor, you had to define this thing, and you're like. There's no certainty, right? That's why there's so much room for error. That's why it's going to keep you up late at night. How do you make the decision? On what grounds? Yeah, Nisa.
I don't understand how that could create anxiety. There's no platonic form of the word in a pure, somewhere.
That's right. So how do you define it? If you have a certainty, if there's something to aspire to, like you can get closer and closer, well, then you can assess yourself. But when there's no closer, how do you know? At what point do you stop? There's no grounds. It's at once a freedom, but it's also a kind of damnation. Because there's no proximity. You can't assess your success by, well, I'm a little bit closer. I'm a little bit closer to God. Right? Well, God's dead. So what are you closer to? You're just standing over here rather than over here. Right? There's no certainty. There's no proof. Right? So how do you know? Is clumsy clumsy? Does Green nail it? You know, some of these I'm persuaded by, some I'm not. You know, Glee, I know just personally, he was never that soul on Glee. He thought it was too boyish. I think Glee is the best thing in here. Glee is just downright fantastic. It's gleeful. What do you think? Think about how you begin to critique one. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Of course you think Glee is good.
Sure. Yeah. But this would open up argument without proof, right? And it wouldn't be contentious argument. It would be the proliferation of another dictionary, right? And that's the beautiful moment. And what I'm asking you to do is feel yourself beginning to discover the sensors with which you would even make such a judgment, right? It's the beginnings to understand the assessment of the comportment of things rather than their truth. And that's really the rhetorical task. We ask, how do things go? Not, what do they mean? Right? And when you can begin to feel simultaneously for the concept and the body of something, with your own body and your concept, then you're beginning to think rhetorically, begin to understand how different things go and what's at stake in those different things. So I ask you again, when you read through this, which do you always agree? Is bulwark bulwark? Is it hard to get through? Is it clumsy? I mean, is it, it's not really clumsy. Is it an obstacle? Is it bulwarky? Is purple purple enough? I think pixel is hot, man. Pixel just nails it. Ask yourself this. Read this over the weekend and ask yourself, do I agree? And not is it wrong, but do I have a different argument for how this thing could go? Right? Could I make another poetical dictionary? Think about making another poetical dictionary of only these words. right? And trying to, and saying, you know, inflecting them differently and seeing how they could be inflected differently. It would be a strange project, but kind of a beautiful one in which you might begin to think about this very elusive but very real a faculty of assessment, faculty of judgment, a judgment that's not moral, a judgment that's not absolute, but a judgment nonetheless. Right? A judgment that's not condemning, but a judgment nonetheless. The formation of an argument that's not based on a proximity or certainty or standard, but an assessment nonetheless. All right, so who has a, who wrote a good one? Anybody? Remy. Oh, yeah, read it to us. Yeah, I just did, though. What do you mean you didn't say that? I just said it. Are you really too shy to read it?
Do you want to read it out loud?
No?
I stutter when I read.
Is that okay? If someone else wants to read, do you want to hand it to someone else to read? I don't want to make anyone uncomfortable. You can take your time. We don't mind. Stuttering's beautiful.
Bare your teeth at disdain and curtly spit it out as you speak. In self. Verb, Latin and French, most commonly associated with the letter. One, a word commonly known by those with any semblance of intelligence, the act of causing offense, but much error, in definition to its variety of forms, you understand. Two, to put it simpler and egotistical act, such a cockering for an act. Usually done to prove mental superiority and uses some logic lost by the ignorant. Three, be assured more definition could be wrought, but for want of time better spent, unable to waste any more on unimportant matters. Have a nice day.
Ah, see, good. Why do I like that? Why does that nail it? Because there's different ways you can approach this. Because some people, when I give this assignment, write beautiful things, but they perform a kind of poetry inspired by the word, right? So they give a poetical, like a poetry definition. But why is Remy's good? Why does it fit in the form here? Exactly, right? It insults you, right? So an insult, and what was nice is it wasn't totally insulting, right? So it was both in it, because an insult is also something you look at. It doesn't have to be insulting to you, an insult per se. You did a nice job of doing both. Right, giving the sense of the word, but then also one of the senses is to insult somebody. Does that make sense? Anyone else want to read theirs? Thank you very much, Remy. Come on, somebody. Yeah.
Face. A means of identification. Countenance. One. An artifact that intelligently executes physical verbalization. An entertaining performance which takes place upon the visage. An expression of the various perspectives and individual experiences. It gesticulates spoken plots, an instrument of constant physical communication, a conduit of beliefs or opinions. Two, the way in which society takes into consideration the moral character or integrity of a human being. It represents social perceptions of prestige, societal competence and moral character, a social construct which conveys an individual's power and influence. Three, a heterogeneous reflection of the world which alters its ontogenetic state of latency. A continuously changing outward appearance of something.
Wow. That was nifty. What do you make of this one? Face is hard. Face is a bold one. Face is a challenge for a good reason, the way hand is in here. What did you make of that? Did he nail face? You know what I was kind of secretly waiting for? Did you guys ever say face when you were in like middle school or something when you were young? Right? Like somebody in your face, but we should just do face. So I was waiting for the verb, you know.
I thought that he gave a lot of information, and
basically
you give a lot of information. So I thought that was appropriate.
That's very interesting. Very interesting. Everybody hear that? Say that again.
He gave a lot of information, and faces gave a lot of information.
Right. That the argument was that about faces, definitely gave an argument. I like that. It was very argumentative. About what a face is, that a face is an information-giving vehicle, and this thing gave a lot of information. That I thought you were going to go much sparer, in a way. But then you actually performed your own definition, in this kind of cool way. Yeah, that's nice. That was a nice little collaboration there. Anyone else want to feel like they, you know? Because I think these are always really good. People always rise to the occasion, write really nice ones. interesting ones. So I want to give you the opportunity to show off a little bit. If nobody wants to, I won't put you on the spot. That doesn't interest me so much. Anybody feel good? Want to lay it on me? All right, no one wants to. All right, what a surprise. Give it to me, guy. Okay, good. It's a good, definitely a good definition of transliterate. What do we think of it as a performative? I took on another big one where I think what I kind of was waiting for was obviously the transliteration of something, right? Internal, like using anachronisms and then transliterating them, right? Or like, you know, a Cyrillic or something. Right, do you know what transliteration is? Right, you know, growing up, you know, in like really reformed Judaism, no one can read Hebrew, so that, you know, everything's transliterated. Right, I you know, when I was bar mitzvah, I had to give an entire, you know, service in transliterated Hebrew. You know, I that's what I was waiting for. What do you think of that? It's complicated. It's complicated. I like it. I got to think about it a little bit. All right, let's think about for Tuesday. I want you, we might keep talking about this, but you know what? You got to read the Phaedrus, okay? Stop moving for 1 second here. One thing about the Phaedrus, okay? You're going to get annoyed and bored now and again, but I want you to remember a couple things. One, it's hilarious, okay? It's very, very funny. Two, it's very, very naughty, okay? So if you think that naughty things are happening, they are. Three, if you're getting bored, you got to make it, I want you to read the whole thing because the ending is very important to really understand what happens in the beginning. You definitely got to make it through the first two speeches, okay? First two speeches, Lysias' speech and Socrates' first speech, okay? Weekend well. Oh, and hand in your things to me.